Okay, well, hello everyone. Thanks again so much for joining us here in this special bonus. I guess maybe you don't see it so much as a bonus, but an additional podcast here for week four. We're building from the topics on week four, given the fact that we weren't able to get to some important things in class last week. And I will try to keep this short because I know you only have so much time, and I want you to listen to the podcast for week five, which will also be coming out soon. So I'm going to just, and given I said if you've done the reading and you've taken a look at the notes I've distributed, I think that gives you a pretty firm foundation, as well as our excellent student presentation last week to build upon. So I will try to keep this short and just emphasize a few important things. And one is this kind of ongoing interplay of the physical or material reality of colonial governance and the expressions of dominance and power that it involved in colonial governance with what we would often consider more ideological factors in terms of shaping the narrative that seek to describe and legitimate the colonial system and the imposition of colonial rule in Korea, right? And importantly, to see the interactions between these two. If you remember all the way back, I know it seems so long ago now, to week one, we talked about, you know, emphasizing material versus ideological factors in terms of understanding the flows and process of history. And of course, as is often the case, it's very often a matter of both, right? And here in our approach to understanding the era of colonial rule in Korea, both as it was implemented by the Japanese authorities and it was, you know, Koreans responded to it in a variety of different ways and had a large ongoing debate and discourse over what it meant to exist under the Japanese colonial system, we can see this interaction of material conditions and ideology, right? And another theme that I wanted to highlight that is gone over in the notes and in a broad way, I mean, of course, this first period of the colonial era from 1910 to 1919 is known in Korea as Amhugi, which is, as stated in the notes, the dark period. I mean, this ties to, I think, where a lot of these factors come together. So that's going to be kind of the main point I'm going to try to make before leaving you to your weekend and whatever else you have going on. And what we see during this period is an aspect of colonial rule that it's a feature in all places that have experienced and in all societies that have attempted to implement some sort of colonial system of domination or control, is that the colony is by and large viewed in terms of its ability to serve the central government. And that might seem kind of obvious maybe, but I think it's important to think about understanding the ebbs and flows and the changes that take place during this 35-year period of Japanese colonial rule in Korea and how Japanese authorities viewed the colonial Korea as a colonial territory and what it could or should provide the Japanese Empire and the central government in Tokyo would affect the nature of governance and how governance was carried out within the colonial system. And so that helps to kind of give us an idea for how things and changed and for what reason. And particularly during this first period, Korea was largely seen as a site of extraction, right? Primarily agricultural, perhaps a little bit less so minerals and other natural resources, but primarily agriculture and rice. Especially Japan was experiencing, as we mentioned, over the previous decades, a rapid urbanization, which will lead to an expanding population. And this is very, you know, kind of base human stuff, but, you know, more people, more concentrated people, less people doing farming, and you need more food to supply to this urban workforce. And in that way, Korea was seen as an important asset above and beyond anything else. And also, this was tied to, in that sense, seeing Korea as a site to kind of control and to coerce, right? Coercion and extraction is the theme I have in the notes. And in a sense that there wasn't any notion of trying to develop Korea as a, you know, integrated into Japan in any sort of meaningful sense, but actually to kind of, again, repress and control the population, intimidate the population, and extract resources from Korea, right, and send them back to Japan for the increasing development of urban industrial society within Japan, right? And this, and we can see this play out in a whole host of areas, right? Notably, as mentioned in the notes, there was the very despised company law that really limited the ability for Koreans to participate in any meaningful way in the economy. There was laws restricting the ability for Koreans to have any sort of significant role in the government general, in the Japanese colonial government system, right? And there was also, at more of a ground or street level, a very, for the time, quite sophisticated and quite aggressive and violent system of control and domination at the street level, often carried out by the police, who basically were given almost unlimited authority to decide and carry out kind of instant justice, which could involve beatings, whippings, and all sorts of very violent forms of intimidation. And these sorts of practices are not simply about controlling the person who is on the receiving end of such acts, but also perhaps even more importantly, from the eyes of attempting to control a population, to send messages to others, right? And so often these were carried out in very public and very visible ways as a message to others about the danger of transgressing the very tight restrictions on colonial policy. There was severe restrictions, as we mentioned, on a whole host of activities that Koreans could undertake, not just in business and government, but in terms of where they could go, what they could do. There was, efforts to try to have the children in school, controlling the curriculum was largely the colonial government had pretty much full control of the education system and the curriculum, and was able to utilize that to begin its mission of also instituting a set of ideological principles within Korean society at this time that were amenable, or at least the government, the government general thought were amenable to its interests. And that is, again, where we can see these material and ideological factors come together. There's a few quotations in the notes that I gave you. And one of them is from Schmidt. You can look, it's in a gray box. I believe that's on page 6. And it says, one of colonialism's most powerful ways of dominating Korea was controlling the ways that the Korean past could be mobilized for political purposes, right? And this is something that really brings together so many things we've talked about over the first few weeks of the course. Again, even going back to week one, that history is, on one level, trying to understand and accurately recount the past to the best degree possible, and in some ways weave together a narrative of the past that tells us what has happened. But it also is political in the sense that history is not one thing, and that people try to mobilize, as Schmidt says, mobilize history for politics, and that a lot of the original run of what we would consider more kind of quote-unquote modern kind of academic history on Korea was done by the Japanese colonial authorities. And that was a history that was obviously created to fit their political purposes, that told of, the Korean people as, losing their way, not able to civilize, not be able to become civilized as a society that has been in kind of stasis and has no ability to progress. And in that narrative, able to present the colonial regime as the kind of savior, as this entity that's going to come in and uplift the Korean people. And this obviously because of the unique nature of Korea and Japan's long-standing set of relations and close cultural ties through shared Sino kind of practices, was weaved into this kind of broader ethno-political narrative where Koreans were this kind of distant cousin of the Japanese people. And in some ways, the colonial project in Korea was about helping this distressed cousin who had gone astray, right? To use the kind of metaphor. And history was a mechanism, and the way history was constructed and told was seen as a mechanism for legitimating the colonial regime as an idea. And this will tie into something we're going to talk about next week as well, which is this whole dilemma or kind of contradiction of assimilation, right? Where during this period, even though Koreans were technically living in Japan due to the annexation and were at least officially told that they were Japanese citizens, technically the same as others, there were all of these laws and practices and actions would continually reinforce the notion that Koreans were to be, considered inferior and second-class citizens. And these are the kinds of things that create such bitterness in terms of memories. We'll talk more about this over the next several weeks, but we can point out here that already during this first period, we can see in a host of instances where Koreans are quite literally become, even wealthy and prominent Koreans have become quite literally second-class citizens in their own country, right? In terms of what they could do and also the rights they had in terms of their treatment by the authorities and the police, where, again, the police had basically unrestricted authority to decide and carry out justice on the ground level as they saw fit. Increasingly, a lot of these police would be Koreans themselves, which is going to create another series of painful legacies, which is something we will talk more about in the weeks to come. So I know there's a lot more I would like to say, but again, I don't want to overburden you with too many minutes of podcasts here. So hopefully what we can take away from this is that this period was one of harsh repression and one that involved a very increasingly vast bureaucratic apparatus that was the Japanese colonial system. The government general in Korea that operated with a large amount of autonomy began to come to have ability to reach into and to shape the nature of life in Korea at the most granular level. Another example of this, and this is mentioned in the notes, was the large cadastral survey that was carried out where the government general went basically bit by bit over every piece of available farming and forestry land in Korea and measured it and created plots and then redistributed land based upon its own evaluation. There was, actually some wealthier Koreans tried to, were able to take advantage of this because, again, in pre kind of quote unquote modern society, a lot of these things were held by customary standards, right? People's land. There wasn't deeds and specific lines drawn in the ground, and the process of drawing these lines and deciding, the boundaries of this property is itself a process that allowed the colonial government to institute high levels of precise control and bureaucratic control that had not existed in even the most powerful governments of the Joseon dynasty, right? And this process, this period was one where this kind of large, vast bureaucratic entity, as reflected even in these kind of micro or specific instances of the cadastral survey, came to weave its way into all aspects of Korean society and life from the village level all the way up to some of the larger cities. And it was one that was rooted in a great deal of violence, intimidation, and repression. And ultimately seeking to pacify and control the Korean population, all the while being able to extract resources, particularly agricultural resources, and send them back to Japan. That really is the big characterization, and we can see. And at the same time, as we mentioned, to institute a set of ideological parameters that justified and legitimated the colonial regime based upon its own characterization and creation of Korean history. And by the time we get to this period, and this is what I think will be interesting because next week we'll begin talking about the March 1st movement in 1919, was that by the time we get to the 1918 or so, many in the government general thought this, they had set it up. The Koreans were in control. Japan was able to access the resources it wanted. The population had been basically pacified. There was no more active resistance. And from the perspective of many in the Japanese government, colonial government general, the mission had been accomplished. There were large amounts of private Japanese citizens that were carrying out businesses in colonial Korea, which is another major aspect of this story. And so everything seemed to be going, quote unquote, well from their perspective. And the event of March 1st, 1919, I'm saying this to characterize how much this kind of took the government general by shock, by, you know, how much it shocked them, because they had basically assumed that they had effectively achieved their primary goals vis-a-vis what they were looking for from Korea as a colony. Okay, well, thank you for listening, and make sure also to check out the podcast for week 5, and I look forward to seeing everyone next week.